Erdogan has been a repressive figure for decades. He has circumscribed freedom of expression. He has cracked down on universities and college students, on the LGBT community. You can go down the line. The concern here, I think, is not simply that Erdogan stays in power, but rather that we're seeing something a little bit scary. We're seeing something. It's a movement from an Orban-like electoral authoritarian regime to something that might be more similar to a Putin or Sisi type dictatorial regime.
Welcome to This Just Talk. I'm your host, Hami. Joining us today is Dr. Howard Eisenstadt, the Laurentian Associate Professor of Middle East History at St. Lawrence University, my alma mater, and a non-resident fellow at Stockholm University Institute for Turkish Studies. And today, we'll be discussing the historic shift, the decision by the leadership of the Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK, to disband. And he'll help us understand what does this mean for Kurdish politics and armed resistance, whether or not this is a genuine move towards peace or a strategic repositioning, and more broadly, how do we make sense of this moment in the broader context of the Kurdish people and their long struggle. Without further ado, Dr. Eisenstadt, let's jump right in. Welcome to the Just Talk, by the way. On May 12th, the PKK announced that it will be ending its armed campaign, and the group already had declared unilaterally a ceasefire in February. And after its imprisoned founder, Abdullah Öcalan, called the group to dissolve and pursue political and not military means of struggle. Can you help us understand this current moment, your read of the announcement, and whether or not this is really a turning point or something more symbolic? And more importantly, why now, in its long history of struggle?
Thanks so much, Rami, and thanks for having me on. I think that there on the Turkish side, there's a desire to bring in Kurdish votes for possible constitutional change, while at the same time repressing opposition parties that seem resistant to it. So it's an effort to pull in new allies while limiting the power of other parts of the opposition. On the Kurdish side, I think the situation is a little bit more complex. A lot of this, I think, has to do with the precarious position of the Kurds in Syria, the SDF, who are very, very clearly worried about the withdrawal of the United States, which had been allied to them these past years, are very worried about Turkish influence on the new Syrian government, and don't want to be isolated with a Turkish military that is clearly winning on the battlefield. Turkey has developed a very effective counterinsurgency program over the last decade or so, particularly using new weapons. Drone warfare has proven very effective against insurgent movement throughout the world. And so I think part of this has to do with the hopes of maintaining at least some semblance of that Kurdish identity in northern Syria, which had been sort of the center of Kurdish hopes for the last decade. The second part, I think, has to do with Abdullah Öcalan's isolation. He's been in jail since 1999. The Turkish government has very much limited his ability to talk to other people, to read broadly. He's been in a type of isolation that has been routinely condemned by human rights organizations, and it's really not clear to me and or I think anybody who's been following it exactly what his thinking is. How much of this is about trying to salvage the Kurdish movement before he passes? How much of it is a general shift in his thinking? How much of it might be self-interest and trying to get better living conditions at the end of his life? He's certainly been developing his thinking about Kurdish nationalism and Kurdish identity over the last 15 years or so, and has shown evolution. How much of that is self-interest? How much of that is a real shift in ideology, I think, is anybody's guess.
Speaking of Kurdish identity, Kurdish nationalism, before we even dive into more about what this moment mean, I'm wondering if you could like help place the current moment in history, and give us a little bit of historical context to help us understand the dynamics here, and also help us understand the different parties that are involved, from Turkey to Syria to Iraq to Iran.
So, I don't want to delve too deeply into the many different factions of Kurdish national identity. Kurdish nationalism, the first iterations of it come, sort of with the beginnings of nationalism in the Middle East in the late 19th century. There was, I think, a really limited Kurdish nationalist movement in the first half of the 20th century. You can find these moments, but a lot of certainly Kurds during World War I and in the immediate aftermath assumed that they would be part of some larger Muslim polity, and it's only with the creation of national states that were very self-consciously Turkish or Arab or Iranian that they realized that they were being sort of marginalized in the new political structures. I think the first real Kurdish nationalist movements are a product of the Cold War. They are modeled on national resistance movements elsewhere. They are often Marxist in character, though a lot of times the alliance systems that they're based on is closely connected to tribal affiliations. The PKK, the most prominent of them, was very much out of this sort of national as liberation thinking. It saw itself as Marxist. It saw itself as engaging in sort of a traditional movement of the countryside against against the center. And during the Cold War, it was able to find alliances within Cold War structures to act as resistance. It feels like you have a question coming up, so
No. I'm no. Keep going. Keep going.
I think what happens in the post-Cold War era is that the ground shifts pretty dramatically under them. They're able to maintain some degrees of financing through drug trade and things like that, but they very quickly find themselves limited in their capacities and the Öcalan in particular is he's pushed out of Syria. He goes into exile. And then with the aid of the United States and Israel, Turkey arrests him in 1999, and he's been in jail ever since. The PKK has continued to survive. It was, but I, as I said in my initial comments, I think limits on its capacity for self-financing and changes in the technology of warfare have fundamentally undermined its capacity to engage in national resistance. At the same time, Öcalan, who's sort of been framed as the main ideologue of the movement, has been moving steadily away from sort of a traditional Kurdish nationalism, the idea of creating a separate state, to sort of arguing for some sort of integration with the Turkish state.
And so to build on that a little bit, before we dive into the political calculations of Erdogan, I'm wondering if you could like tell us how this shift impacts the different factions within the Kurdish nationalist movement, whether there is the Kurdish Democratic Party in Iraq or the Democratic Union Party in Syria, I believe, and the Free Life Kurdistan at PJAK in Iran, and obviously the PKK, the one that we hear about the most. Since you pay attention to the region, but the rest of us don't. What are the dynamics between these four different parties that sort of espouse different forms of wanting to reach a certain form of like Kurdish national identity?
Yeah, so I think the situation in Iraqi Kurdistan is quite different. Because they do have a state, and they have a different sort of ideological tradition. They come out of a local leadership to a much larger degree. The SDF in Syria, the YPG in Syria, is very closely affiliated to Öcalan, and I think that there's a challenge to thinking about Kurdish politics from the outside.
Right.
In that, on the one hand, there is this public veneration of Öcalan as an individual that is very in the open. His face is everywhere. His image, his name are invoked repeatedly. At the same time, he's been out of the picture for decades.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that you know, very clearly these organizations have evolved without him in their local context, looking at local opportunities. I think that the evolution of the diminishing capacities of the PKK within Turkey, and the development of the SDF under US umbrella in Syria, those things happened simultaneously, and I think that at some level, the leadership was likely taken aback by Öcalan's. Really, I don't think we can sugarcoat it. It was a capitulation, and Öcalan really he didn't talk about a process leading towards disbandment. He was talking about disbandment that would lead to a process, right? You know, Öcalan is this sort of central figure. You know, it's. I think that leadership had very little choice but to say, yes, we're going to do this. And now it remains to be seen what it actually means in practice.
Yeah, and that's interesting the way you frame it. Disbandment leading to a process rather than a process leading to disbandment. That also raises questions like, amnesty for the people that have been involved in the movement, political representation, their ability to be recognized by a state, their ability to cast a vote in whatever state or locality that they're located in. Access to language rights, and all these things that, like, historically, the Kurdish people or marginalized people have been fighting for, or at least purported that is the reason for their engagement in resistance, which is a desire for some sort of like self-determination or autonomy. And none of those seem to be answered so far. So you're right, very interesting to see how all of this will unfold. But I'm also wondering, since you mentioned the involvement of the United States in shaping the group within Syria, what the dynamics or is will be with like Hayat Tahrir al-Sham now governing Syria. Does that play any role in the calculus? Is this now sort of the counterbalance to HTS? Will the Kurdish party be the counterbalance to HTS in Syria?
So, I think that it was clear for some years that the United States' investment in Syria was diminishing, and it really had Assad remained in power. I think the United States was slowly losing interest, and I think under a Trump administration certainly would have lost interest. Under the new government. I think that sped up the process. And so what we've seen, the YPG was negotiating with the Assad regime, trying to to broker some system for integrating, retaining some level of autonomy before the collapse of the Assad regime. Now that the Assad regime has collapsed, they've been reaching out to the new government. The new government, of course, is in many ways, it's a very close ally of Ankara, and so it sharpened the need on the part of, or it sharpened the risks on the part of the SDF, the YPG, to if they didn't create some sort of negotiated off ramp with the new government in Damascus.
And so I want to change trajectory a little bit to go to talk about Ankara since you brought it up. Some are arguing that, the Turkish government interest in disbanding the PKK is not either about peace or national unity or inclusion or anything like that, but rather Erdogan's own political calculus. What do you make of, what's your read of, what Erdogan is trying to accomplish? Is it co-opting this news cycle to secure his own power? And can you give our audience an update on like what's been happening inside of Turkey?
So let me take this the second part first, because I think that it's really important to recognize that the Kurds are only part of the opposition to Erdogan's authoritarianism. That the Turkey is in the end a 50-50 country. Like a lot of electoral authoritarian governments, the government has not attempted to do away with elections. It simply has tried to fix them so that it maintains enough control in parliament to control levers of power. For a number of reasons, including Erdogan's own term limits, the unpopularity of his own coalition, he has begun a crackdown on the largest opposition party in Turkey, the CHP. He's arrested their most popular leader. He's arrested a bunch of mayors. That's sort of the big domestic Turkish story of the last few months. Is Turkey moving from an electoral authoritarian government to something more approaching a dictatorship?
Right.
For Erdogan to get to retain power beyond his current term, which ends in 2028, he needs a constitutional change, or he needs some sort of auto coup, right? He either does away with the electoral system entirely, which has very high costs, or he manages to create a wider, a broader majority in parliament, and the Kurds can provide him with that. The pro-Kurdish party, the Dem party, has typically been in opposition to the governing AKP, but it also has reservations about the main opposition party.
Right.
And so this brings them into play. And you asked about what would be the outcomes of this process. Those are being negotiated between not the PKK and the government, but rather the Dem Party, this democratically elected pro-Kurdish party that, yes, has, you know, some ties, some affiliations with the PKK, but really is its own separate thing.
Right.
And so, you know, they're negotiating issues of governance. They're negotiating issues of release of political prisoners. The hope on the part of the governing coalition, the hope on the part of Erdogan, is that by building relations with Dem Party, that gives them at least enough to call a referendum. And that would allow them to change the constitution in ways that, you know, there would probably be some reform-like elements of a constitutional change to make it more attractive to the electorate. But the bottom line is it provides a pathway for Erdogan to stay in power.
Wow.
And I think at the core, whether we're looking at the crackdown on the main opposition CHP, or we're looking at the negotiations with the Kurds, from the Turkish perspective, this is about keeping Erdogan in power.
And from the reactions, at least from a Westerner perspective, from what we see on the in the media, it doesn't seem like that's a popular thing. About Erdogan continuing his rule.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people broadly, whether we're talking about right, left, or center, west, or east, I think the end of conflict between Turkey and the Kurds, if this ends military conflict, that's a good thing.
Yes.
This was a no-win conflict that had had lasted for decades and killed tens of thousands of people, yes, including many, many civilians. So I think that there's something to be, you know, whatever else is going on, whatever the other repercussions are, that's a net win. I think that in general, Erdogan has been a repressive figure for decades. He has circumscribed freedom of expression. He has cracked down on universities, on college students, on the LGBT community. You know, you can go down the line. The concern here, I think, is not simply that Erdogan stays in power, but rather that we're seeing something a little bit scarier. We're seeing something it's a movement from an Orban-like electoral authoritarian regime to something that might be more similar to a Putin or Sisi type dictatorial regime. Right. So the concern is that the crackdown on the CHP, precisely because the CHP is such a significant, both in terms of size and in terms of legacy, part of the Turkish political system, that crackdown reflects something, a change in kind of the sort of what sort of authoritarianism we're looking at in Turkey.
Sort of joining the long list of countries where democratic institutions are eroding.
Well, I guess I would put a, I mean, so if we're looking at electoral authoritarianism, sort of rigging the system, but still having contested elections, right? That's clearly a problem in many Western democracies, and we're seeing that at home and abroad. What we're talking about in the case of Turkey, because Turkey has been an electorally authoritarian regime for more than a decade now, right? What we're looking at is something that's actually more an intensification of that. So Turkey moved from what we might call illiberal democracy to electoral authoritarianism sometime at the beginning of the last decade. You can say 2013, you can say 2016. There's different ways of counting it, but that process of moving towards electoral authoritarianism to a fundamentally to elections that were fundamentally unfair, that process has already been around for a long time. What we're talking about now is something potentially much worse than that. Something, I mean, when Orban runs for office, he has lots of advantages, but we really don't know who's going to win. When Sisi runs for office, he has lots of advantages, and we already know who's going to win. We don't have to wait up late at night to find out. And when Putin runs for office, we don't have to wait up to find out. And that's the challenge. Turkey may be moving from a place where you had to wait late to find out to someplace where you don't actually have to bother.
And I want to zoom out a bit, right? And sort of bring us so close by thinking about what's at stake regionally, like thinking about the entire region, because this isn't just about Turkey, right? The Kurds are a major actor in Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And sort of the collapse and success of this process could reshape the regional dynamics, especially with the US disengaging and shifting Israeli interests, right? And so, like, I was reading, for example, some scholars who are, we're making the argument Erdogan helped bring the black flags to Damascus with HTS winning. And that was like the principal argument that they were putting up. And others arguing the Kurds want to ally themselves with Israel because they know Israel has an interest in keeping Syria sort of like this fragmented, non-centralized governments. So, how do you see all of this unfolding across these countries, and sort of thinking about the stability of the region, as these different great powers continue vying for hegemony in the region?
So I mean, I guess there's so much going on in the region right now that this is only really a small part of it. I mean, what we've seen just to you know, we've the United States is clearly less interested in the region, and is you know, the long-awaited reset is in process. Iran has really taken a drubbing in its regional standing, its allies in Syria, its allies in Lebanon, its allies in Palestine have all been either overthrown or back-footed. Iran has demonstrated that it's not willing to go to the mat for its proxies. And the irony of that is that's actually created a rapprochement with between Iran and some of the Gulf states, because the Gulf states no longer see Iran as an existential threat. They're now willing to open up you know, more of a pragmatic relationship. So the biggest part of this, I think, has to do with Turkey, which has emerged as one of the big regional players. It's certainly not the only one. I think that I think that that's overstated, but Turkey has certainly played a key role in the success of al-Shara in Syria. I don't think that al-Shara is Turkey's puppet, but he's certainly taking cues from them. They have certainly helped him manage his public relationship. Erdogan has the advantage of a burgeoning weapons industry. He's had, by and large, a successful regional foreign policy for the last few years. There's already been a rapprochement between Turkey and Saudi Arabia. He seems to have good relations with Trump, which has helped ameliorate relations between Turkey and Israel. I think that fundamentally, what we're seeing is the Kurdish issue receding in a way that I don't think that that's necessarily like the inevitable trajectory. I don't think that this is necessarily the end of a Kurdish resistance movement. I can imagine some elements of the PKK deciding that no, they're going to hold out, they're going to rename themselves, rebrand themselves, and continue to advocate for greater autonomy. But for right now, I think what we're seeing is a reassertion of national states in the region, and a new coalition of regional not rivals but partners. I think there are limits to what I think Israel's engaged in overstretch, and there are going to be hard limits on how much more it can do in that regard. I think that Iran's demonstrated weakness has actually opened up the possibility of some broader stabilization in the region. And I think that, you know, the Trump administration is likely, for all of the, you know, all the problems of the Trump administration elsewhere, I think they're likely to be they're going to be less engaged in the region, and thereby less destabilizing for the region than maybe the internationalists of an earlier generation.
Dr. Housenstadt, thank you so much for joining me on Let's Just Talk. I'm so glad I got to speak with you and to learn from you, as I didn't get the chance to sit down and chat with you back at St. Lawrence. I look forward to doing this again and learning more from you moving forward.
Great talking to you.
Thank you.